Good afternoon, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome for another conversation. With this conversation today, I think I'm recording episode 5, but overall, this is episode 224. So welcome to the conversation. My guest today is someone who spent 20 years in the clinic helping more than 10,000 women navigate one of the most emotionally loaded journeys a human being can go through. She wasn't just a practitioner. She was obsessive about the data, about the partners or the patterns that emerge through data, about the hidden signals that mainstream medicine may either missing or dismiss. And when she realized that the answer was finding that she was trying to find couldn't scale through a single clinic, she did something that most clinicians never dare to do. She built technology. And this is very fascinating with me. That's why I want to talk to clinician building technology. Normally they're against technology. She became a founder. Then she built an AI platform, music to my ear, by her own account, actually performed her clinical results. Kristen Karschmer, thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate it. And welcome to the conversation. Let's get into it.
Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Really appreciate it. Kristen, as we, you are the founder and CEO of something called Conceivable Technologies, and yes, it's one of North America's first board certified reproductive and acupuncturist, a former president of the American Board of Oriental Reproductive Medicine. Talk to me a little bit about your story. What got you here? How did you start? Where are you from? Etc. So our audience can connect with you on a personal level first.
Sure. So I grew up in Central Texas in Dallas and Arlington, and I was a competitive gymnast I'm not going back to my beginnings, but it's relevant to how I got here today. And when I was 19, so I was very athletic. I trained a lot in hot Texas gyms. And when I was 19 or 20 years old, I got diagnosed with MS. So I could not walk without a cane anymore. I couldn't see very well. I was exhausted. I was sleeping all the time and ended up going to an acupuncturist totally against my will. One of my friends forced me and I was like, that's shit. Like an acupuncturist is like a psychic. That's not going to do anything. And she's like, your ego is so huge. Like, do you really believe that? Like, what if there was 15% chance it could improve the quality of your life? Wouldn't that be worth at least exploring? And I was like, okay. And that doctor changed my life. Not only because I went into remission after seeing him for a year, but he said something at the end of the consultation that was really interesting. He said, look, when you were born, your body, your constitution was very robust. Everything, all systems go, was very strong. And your disease, MS, was very weak because it's very latent and young. And he's at that point, he goes, your body was strong enough to just resist like the maturation of the disease process. And he goes, but then you trained and trained and trained your whole life. And you, like, on the outside, it looked very Instagrammable, which is really important. If you saw me when I was 19 years old, you wouldn't believe that I had MS because I was, looked like an Olympic gymnast. But on the inside, all of my systems were completely blown out. And he said, look, my job isn't to cure your MS or heal you or any of those things. My job is one thing and one thing only, and that is to get your constitution stronger than your disease. And if we can do that, you might go under remission. And then I did. So after that, I ended up going to acupuncture school and, focusing on women's health. I became obsessed with the menstrual cycle. I'm the only person probably in the whole history of the world to have ever said that, but that what I realized was that every single thing that a woman experiences from day one until she starts her next period for 30 straight days is so diagnostically relevant. And it gives us access to diagnostic information for free every single month. And that's what I worked on in terms of helping people to get pregnant, is really understanding what are the signals that the menstrual cycle is giving us that are predictive of either high or low fertility.
Now, your work has been featured in TechCrunch, Fox News, Healthline, the list goes on. But what I really want to dig into is like the thinking and the framework. What is the idea that started it all this?
Well, a study came out in 2000. I've been in my clinic for 20 years, and a study came out, and I don't know, I'm not good with the past, 2016 or 17 or 18, that said less than 3% of couples could afford fertility treatment. Less than 3%. That means 97% of the people who are dreaming of a family who can't, won't be able to, because they can't even afford a single treatment. That in many countries, one in vitro fertilization cycle is the equivalent of a year's salary. Mm-hmm. It's the only technology that has gotten more expensive over the last 40 years instead of less expensive. And I was really disgusted by that. And I realized that I was also part of that problem. I was a very high touch concierge type care, think four seasons of fertility. And it's in acupuncture, scaling acupuncture is very hard because either you're just like, it's expensive and you're really taking care of the patient, but you can't really make like affordable acupuncture, right? Mm. Just, it's not, you have to hire acupuncturists and things like that. And So yeah, so that's sort of what got me to this point right now. How do we, can we build software that could mimic what we did in clinic? And I didn't believe it to be true, but I wanted to try it anyways. And even in the first version of the app, the data scientist came in and said, he was kind of sheepish. And I knew that there was a lot of pregnancies over 40 years, so 44 months, that was the length of the pilot. And I said, did it not work? He said, oh, no, it worked. We increased the likelihood they would get pregnant by 260%. Now, for context, IVF is about 40%. IUI, which is an insemination, $2,500, 10%. So exponentially higher at a thousandth the cost of IVF, 1/1000th the cost of IVF. And the goal was like, could the AI be 50% as clinically effective as me? And I said, did she get close to me in terms of efficacy? And he said, no. And I said, damn, how bad was he? He goes, no. You got close to her. She beat you by 6%. Because in the pilot, we had 105 women just coming to see me in the clinic and 105 women only using the app with no humans.
Now, what changed in humanity to get to a point where this is a prevalent now? Everywhere I go, I hear about it. I mean, my first marriage, I don't have kids. My first marriage, we had to go through it unsuccessfully. But I don't get it. My parents didn't go through this. The previous generation probably never heard of it. Why are we here
at this stage?
List, I mean, are we here as existential?
We could spend the whole hour talking about this, but some of the biggest ones are, you know, people don't move very much anymore, or they move too much. Like this CrossFit trend, women who do CrossFit are 50% less likely to get pregnant than those who don't.
Wow. Did you hear that, ladies and gentlemen? For those of you who are athletics out there are trying to get up in the morning at 5 o'clock to do CrossFit, keep that in mind.
They haven't done the data on, you know, for men, but for women, we interviewed 16,000. And the second one is that women are exhausted. We interviewed 16,000 women last year and we asked them a really important question in the work that we do is like, what's your energy level? Because if you can't make, conserve, and restore energy, no other functions work, right? And when we interviewed them, we said, what's your energy like on a 1 to 10 with no caffeine or exercise for 2 whole days. Out of 16,000, 60% said their energy was 6 or below. 40% said their energy was 4 or below. There's no way, like making humans is very resource dependent, but we've created a culture, a hustle culture, a culture that says that 6 hours of sleep is fine, that a culture where we don't eat real food anymore, a culture where the food that we do eat, even if you're shopping from Whole Foods, if it's grown in the US, it's very low quality. You know, if you go to Europe, you won't believe, even though you're eating so much worse, how much better you feel because they do a lot better job. There's a lot more rules and regulations around, like, you know, farming and things like that. So those are some of the biggest ones. And then also, I think especially on Instagram, this like beauty culture, so they say in Chinese medicine, beauty culture is driving. Mm-hmm. Like I have a 20-year-old daughter who lives with me. And if you go into her bathroom, there are like 1,000 products. She's 20 years old. I mean, I use some stuff on my neck, wrinkles and things like that. She's 20 years old. She's got perfect skin, perfect hair. She doesn't need any products, but they have really been conditioned that you need all of these products, but all of those products contain forever chemicals.
I see.
So, you know, and those forever chemicals are extremely disruptive to hormones, particularly to men's hormones. Those chemicals can, the testicle has like a little wrapper around it, kind of like the blood-brain barrier. It's supposed to protect the sperm, right? Because the sperm contain the DNA and it's highly protected, but these chemicals can actually penetrate through that barrier and enter the DNA of the sperm and not only impact the man's fertility, but his offspring's fertility as well.
Wow. So we brought this on ourselves, basically what you're saying.
We almost always do, but not, I mean, it's really just through, we get excited about something. We start doing it a lot. It feels good when you do it. And then all of a sudden you're like, wow, nobody can get pregnant. There's some studies that show that skinny jeans, like men's fertility has really declined.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was first in practice 25 years ago, men's fertility accounted for about 25%, and now it's a solid 50%. So skinny jeans, phones in your pockets, all of these chemicals, working out too much, not working out enough, not getting enough sleep. You know, so many people are just like, I can make it. I can make it. I can burn through it. I can use an emergency. I can use a power drink or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Now, reproductive acupuncture was not established as a specialty when you started. So it was not established at the point. That's my understanding, unless I'm getting this wrong. What did it feel like to operate in that space before there was a name for it?
Well,
I think you started it all, didn't you?
Reproductive acupuncture is actually 3,000 years old. So it's very interesting. They just didn't have a license for it in the US yet. But
that's what I was referring to, the US part.
The license part. But what's really interesting, what's more interesting than my response to what I would say to that is that 3,000 years ago in the Qing Dynasty, you had the emperor. The emperor had a lot of wives and the wives were supposed to have a lot of babies. And so each wife had an imperial doctor who came in every single morning, looked at her tongue, felt her pulse, talked to her, tracked her menstrual cycle, and then based on what they found that day, told the chef this is what she's going to eat, gave her acupuncture if she needed, made her a tea of Chinese herbal medicine, told her how much she should move, told her how much she should sleep, because that one doctor's only job was to get her pregnant as many times as possible. And so actually it was like one of the most revered professions in, you know, Qing Dynasty. Because if you're really good at it, you produced a lot of offsprings for the emperor. And translating it until now, yeah, the board certification is probably 15 years old for reproductive acupuncture. I was actually one of the first board certified reproductive acupuncturists in North America and later became the president of that governing board.
What does Western medicine think of all this?
There's data for Chinese medicine. The problem is that a lot of the data look at what acupuncture in isolation can do if everybody gets the same treatment. And that's just not even Chinese medicine, right? The thing that's good about Chinese medicine is every treatment is personalized to what your body is signaling right now. Despite that, there is still really good data. And you'll find some doctors who think it's bull, and you'll find some doctors who are really into it. I'm in part of Baylor Scott & White in Texas is my insurance. We have acupuncture covered. So that's a really good signal. I mean, they want to cover it for things like pain, which acupuncture is very good for. I don't think it's not as good as the technology is for fertility, though.
How did you build an institution in a field that doesn't yet fully exist? How many reproductive, you know, Eastern medicine out there, practitioners out there right now? Do you have an idea? Or
I don't know. I think at one point I thought there was about 30,000 acupuncturists in the U.S., which is not that many, and probably 1% of them are board certified reproductive acupuncturists. What was your question, though?
I was just, how did it feel like to bring all this together, like as an institution? You built an institution around, right? So the American Board of Oriental Reproductive Medicine.
Actually, the real founder died, unfortunately. A good friend of mine, he passed away. Ray Rubio is the real founder of it. But, you know, I never thought about building an institution, but I'm a polymath. And a polymath is like a type of neurodivergence, kind of, in which you see things in patterns, which you see even when I answer your questions, I'm a little bit all over the place. It's because I'm connecting dots that no one would ever connect. That's my natural way of being.
And I thought I was the only one who did that.
No, look up polymath and you'll be like, my God, that is me. That is so me. You know, people are like, whoa, you like art, you know, my development team, especially because what I have built for my team to build is like 15 years of work for them to do. They're like, whoa, slow down. We got to just get this ring integrated or whatever. So I never think of the thing, you know, I often do a lot of crazy things. It's literally because I can't not. I just see connections between things and then I get super excited about it and then I try to go build it. Thank God for AI. AI for me is like having been hiking in the desert for 2 weeks, ran out of food and money and water. And then somebody takes me to Whole Foods and say, hey, by the way, food is free now. Just go get whatever, as much of you drink, eat as much as you want. Everything's free now. That's what AI feels for a polymath, because like, you know, in 2 days you can build something that would take 10 years. It would have cost us like $50 million to build Conceivable now if we couldn't have like language models.
So for the audience, Conceivable was named one of the most innovative health tech startups by MedTech in 2015 and best fertility app by Healthline in 2016. Now, again, you mentioned it earlier, but I'd like to dig a little bit into this, because most people get into tech or tech startup in your case, and they probably have a bit of an idea how to put the pieces together, or not necessarily like a programmer or a designer or a software architect, but you had no background in that space and you started building. What was the first actual steps and how many times did it break before it worked out?
So this version of Conceivable that we're working with today is not the same version that got those awards. Because AI wasn't available, so they didn't use AI. Hopefully we'll get a lot more awards. The new version is launching this week. But I mean, I'm a person who in many ways, I'm sort of a savant. I can do some things so good and some things I'm just so dumb at. And technology often is one of those, like I can't get my phone to put my email on it right now. But for me, when I built the first version of Conceivable, I was part of an accelerator. And that accelerator was my development team. So they really helped me build the first version of it. And that was where I really cut my teeth on startup, on building technology. And then with the AI piece, as soon as OpenAI launched, I took every class. I took MIT's class, I took Harvard's class, and I was like, I know what to build now. I just need the technical infrastructure to be able to build that. And I did build the first version of the AI app, and now we're rebuilding that version with real like Apple developers, like Apple quality developers.
How many users you have on this platform now?
It hasn't launched yet. We have 50 beta testers right now. The real version will launch in the next week or two. But what's interesting is they are engaging ridiculously. So in like industry standards, if somebody uses your app one time a day, that's about industry normal. Three times a day is very high. Mm-hmm. Our average is 23 times per day.
Wow.
Because they can do so many things. They can get their menus planned. They can get shopping lists. They can connect to Instacart and have it delivered to the house. They can do therapy sessions. They can analyze their data. They can upload pictures of other trackers and get that data analyzed. So what we're really trying to build here is a natural language AI companion that she's there with her 24/7 helping her, you know, and that's how we get real healthcare results, because you build a relationship with your, you know,
it's like almost like an AI coach, right?
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. But it's an AI coach informed on 10,000 hours of consultation with me.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you got to train it, right? So that's the training part. Now, you've said AI outperformed your own clinical results. Can you unpack that a little bit? What were you measuring and how did you know it was working?
So the way that we did that is we modeled it. First, we looked at what is the likelihood of natural conception over 6 months. So that's the mm-hmm. first thing. So what's the line? It's basically starting with age 22. The line is basically like this, you know, with age, just your likelihood of getting pregnant goes down. And then we ran, you know, the two pilots, people in who are getting acupuncture with me and the people who are only using the app. And then we cross-referenced that and we modeled what does the line look for the actual pregnancy rates by age across it. And so you see the first line going down and you see the second line. So we measure success in that pilot by positive pregnancy test. What we're going to partner with academic institutions to validate not only that, but that conceivable also increases your likelihood of a live birth. We just didn't have the money to do it when we did the first version of it. It's like a $1.5 million study to do. So it's not, it's material.
Now, one of the things that really fascinate me is how you used the camera on a smartphone to collect data. So tongue analysis piece was fascinating to me. So you take a picture of, I'm assuming it's the tongue, obviously, that's the name.
Yes.
And using a smartphone camera, replicate the TCM diagnostics tradition. And how do you bridge that world of skeptical investors out there or skeptical doctors? That's what I asked. What does Western medicine think of all this initially? So did you ever have those conversations? Like, is this voodoo or is it science?
The doctor, you know, Robin, the doctor that I worked with, Dr. Arredondo from Positive IVF, we worked together for 15 years, just hand in hand. And when we first started working together, like the first week, he said to me, he's from Mexico and he's very funny. And I always impersonate him. So I'm not being disrespectful here. He's a genius too. He's like, Kirsten, that's how you'd say my name, Kirsten. He's like, I get the feeling that you think that I'm the adjunct therapy here, meaning like he's the alternative medicine. And I was like, I absolutely do. I should be the first line of defense. And if what I do doesn't work, then you get to do IVF. And he's like, oh, mama, you're going to kill me. And on Dr. Appreciation Day, he always called me the voodoo witch doctor, but he always came to me when he was sick. And he always sent his hardest cases to me, like, go see Kirsten. She's got some voodoo shit that can help. And so on Dr. Appreciation Day, he comes into my office and he says, hey, Kirsten, it's Dr. Appreciation Day. And I was like, hey, Paco, congratulations. He goes, why didn't you get me anything? And I said, it's Dr. Appreciation Day. Why didn't you get me anything? And he said, because you're not a doctor. And I said, that's interesting. Because if I'm not a doctor, why do you come to me when you're sick? And why do you always get better? And when you have hard medical cases that you can't solve and you come to me and he goes, just because your voodoo shit works doesn't make you a doctor. And I was like, whatever.
You got to give it back to him someday. You got to give it back to him someday.
I'm going to, because I'm going to win the Nobel Prize in medicine. That's my goal, is to win the Nobel Prize in medicine.
Wow. Heard it first time, guys, on the podcast here. Somebody's goal is to win the Nobel Prize. I'm so admiring Kirsten right now, of her goals, achievements. If this is your goal, nobody set a goal and don't achieve it if you're strong-willed about it. So
I mean, my dad used to always tell me, even though my dad was ultra conservative and not like new age or anything, he loved Zig Ziglar so much and the positive power of positive thinking. And he always would tell me, he's like, you are a river going down a mountain. Nothing can stop you. Anytime you think you're stuck, I want you to just like call up the energy of the biggest river you've ever seen in your life and pull that behind you and push your way through. And I'm the kind of person, you can punch me 100 times in the face and I'll get up 101 times. I might 100%. Be staggering, you know, like you can't break me.
I can see that in you.
But you know, the thing about the Nobel Prize, like it is lofty, but the reason, because I want to prove that we can completely transform women's health for almost free. That's my goal.
Is that stemming from the entire healthcare system structure in the US and in the Western world? where we focus a lot, we spend a lot of money on healthcare in general, but minimal outcomes. Is that where it's coming from?
We don't give a shit about outcomes.
Okay.
We literally don't give a shit about outcomes unless you're a drug manufacturer, right? And you need to get, you know, approved.
Well, the outcome for the drug manufacturer is stock price, isn't it?
Have to get approved. They have to at least show enough efficacy to get approved by the FDA. I mean, the bar is low. Often beats, in those studies, placebo often beats the drug. I mean, the real...
Isn't that scary though? Placebo beats the drug? I mean, for those guys that are out there listening to this podcast, if you're not familiar with the word placebo beats the drug, meaning that I gave you a fake pill, sugar plus whatever, you felt better than taking the actual medicine. It's psychological, is that it?
It is. Like, there's a study out of Stanford, I think it's out of Stanford, that was really interesting, that got me very interested in placebos. So they took a group of individuals, I don't know how they got this approved with IRB, and they put them in front of a computer screen and they connected them to a shocking machine. And they said, there's two shocks you're going to get. One is just a very light shock, you know, just like when you shock yourself on the carpet or whatever, like, ooh. And one is going to be significant enough that you're going to pull your hand away, you know, so a little bit meaty. You're going to see flashing lights, green lights and red lights. You're going to see a light. And then some amount of seconds later, you're going to get a shock. Green, you're going to get the light shock. Red, you're going to get fried. And so they said, you're going to get three sections, 5 minutes each of testing, and it'll be back to back. And so afterwards they interviewed the people and they said, so tell me about your experience with the lighting and the, you know, the shocking. And they said, it was weird. The first 5 minutes, it was very clear. Red, bad, green, almost nothing. But in the middle, it got blurry. They were hypothesizing, like, maybe there was a yellow shock in there that I didn't know, because sometimes it wasn't really bad, but it wasn't bad. The majority of the participants at the end of the study said, for the last 5 minutes, I don't think they gave me any reds. They all got the exact same thing they got in the first one, the pattern.
Oh, wow.
They all got reds and greens. Nothing changed over the 5 minutes, except what they extrapolated from this study was that the brain was so smart that whatever that interval between the light and the shock, I mean, we're talking 5 seconds or something. I can't remember how quick it was, that after the first 5 minutes, brain's like, oh, hell no. Red light. So they already got conditioned. Red light is going to be bad. And they would dump enough dopamine to be pain protective in one session of 15 minutes. So the real unicorns will learn how to harness that.
100%.
That's where I'm going to go, because that's how you make it free.
You know, I wish you all the best. And if they need vote for the Nobel Prize, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to vote, but I'll vote for you.
I appreciate it. Let me do the work first, and then you can vote for it.
And for the audience, if Kirsten is going to go for the Nobel Prize in alternative medicine or whatever medicine category that she wants to go for, I'm 100% supportive. And at the same time, she just gave me an idea. I might do a Nobel Prize for podcasting, and I'm going to run for that.
I love it. Well, because you know what it is? It's like you could have your goal to be like win the Nobel Prize, the Peace Prize, because conversations are a way to make people more peaceful, to educate people. I think that like, especially international podcasting really 100%. Allows people, like so many people have never left, like I live in Texas. So many people have never even left Texas. How can you like have any judgment about anybody else out in the world if you've never even met one other culture in your life, you know?
Yeah. No, we're blessed on the channel. We've got listeners in about 50 countries.
Love that.
The global audience. And it's good. I mean, I started early, and it's an army of one, to be honest. It's myself. What is it? 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago now. And literally, I started on a hope and a prayer. And I wasn't really thinking of anything other than just recording conversation and just sharing them on YouTube. And look where we are right now.
I know.
If you don't mind.
260 episodes? Is that your total?
Yeah, 224, this one. Yeah. Every week, almost now, we record about 10. I record about 10 every week almost.
Holy moly.
Yeah, from various topics, various conversations around the world. So if you don't mind, walk me through the five pillars. If I know nothing, some of our audience probably are uneducated on the topic. If you don't mind, just simplify it for us. Energy, blood temperature, stress hormones, etc. Why these five, and why most practitioners probably miss some of them, not all of them probably, or all of them altogether.
I created them. They're the pillars because I think they're the pillars. The goal is to, you know, when you go to your doctor and you're like, I've been getting migraines, they're like, here, take Imitrex. The question is, why do you have migraines? What's going on?
Yeah, not the root cause, the symptom, right? So that's what we treat.
Exactly. And so those five categories, they're borrowed from Chinese medicine. Like in the Conceivable app, you won't see anything related to Chinese medicine. It's scary for people. It doesn't need to be. The five categories come from Chinese medicine. Energy, that's qi. right? It's so resource dependent to make humans. And if we're tired, then we have to look at the underlying reasons why you're tired. Are you sleeping? Sleep is critically important for fertility and weight management, which is also critical for fertility. If you don't sleep, the hormones that get regulated that regulate appetite and satiety get dysregulated. You want to eat more carbs, you gain weight, impact your fertility, your hormones. If you can't digest, maybe your meals are perfect. Conceivable is planning all your meals for you. You have a chef to cook them, but maybe you have a lot of gas and bloating and fatigue after meals. You can't turn that food into resources. We need resources to make humans. If you don't sleep or not, if you're super stressed or anxious during the day, it burns through your energy. And so we need to, like, if their energy is low, that's the place to start. If their energy is low, the blood piece is the next. It tells us everything about the blood. The blood is like literally lifting up the hood and seeing under. The volume of blood on a period tells us how thick the lining is going to be. The color and quality of the blood tells us the quality of the blood. The timing of ovulation tells us about this. Stress, obviously, because stress does play a significant role. Even stress is not.
Yeah, I had a question on the stress. If you don't mind, break it down for us. That'd be good.
Yeah. So stress is not has not been shown to be a cause of infertility, but it is highly correlated. And the reason is that when we get stressed, one, we use energy, so it makes us more tired. We pump out a lot of adrenaline, which is highly inflammatory to everything, eggs, ovaries, testicles, all of those pieces, your uterine lining. And then the side effect, the consequence of all that adrenaline is then we start pumping out a lot of cortisol. For women, this is belly fat, swollen face, don't sleep well, gain weight, hormonal disruption. But most importantly, cortisol is made from the exact same stuff that progesterone is made from. And progesterone is the pregnancy hormone. If you don't have progesterone, you cannot stay pregnant. So the more stressed you are, the more adrenaline, the more cortisol. The cortisol eats up the bucket of stuff we need to make the progesterone. Then we have a hard time staying pregnant.
This is fascinating. You also make a distinction, Kirsten, between getting pregnant and having a healthy baby. That's another face to that entire conversation. Getting pregnant is one element, but obviously you want healthy babies. That's your desire. I mean, I'm not saying you want to. That's what you hope. That's what you desire as a future parent. That reframe feels very important to me, like, and to the audience. Where does the industry currently get that wrong between the healthy and having healthy babies? Pregnant and healthy babies.
Yeah. So, and the healthy mom too.
Of course.
Right? You know, it's like, how do we... Like, people are just like, your doctor's like, you're not getting pregnant, just keep trying. I'd be like, no, you're not getting pregnant. That is a signal that you're not healthy.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you're sick and anything's wrong. It just means like you're not optimally healthy. I don't want that to sound like a criticism in any way. It's just like your body's going, I'm not quite ready. And so what we want to be doing is identifying those. And with miscarriage and pregnancy loss, it's really devastating. 1 in 6 women can't get pregnant. 1 in 4 pregnancies end in miscarriage, and higher with women who struggled with infertility. So the industry doesn't do anything. They make you have 3 losses. 3 of your children have to die before your doctor will talk to you. Even though your baby might be only 6 weeks, it's still, you know you're pregnant, you've changed.
Sure. Still a lot.
Once you've had 3 losses, they will check for clotting disorders. It's just a blood test. And that is a significant cause of miscarriage, but it's not the only cause. And that's it. And there are literally no other resources. In my opinion, what we're getting wrong about it is we're not preparing women to be pregnant. We're not looking through the lens. Like, even women will do inseminations, IUI, and it costs $2,500. You have to take some drugs that hurt your long-term fertility. They can be really effective, but they don't help you to stay pregnant. There's not any studies that show that doing these increases your likelihood of staying pregnant. So it's really, really important that we figure out, like, in my clinical research, 3 things that have to work for people to stay pregnant. They can't be too exhausted, so they need good energy. I like 8 out of 10. Temperatures get to the 98s after ovulation. No one has ever said that before, but we saw that in 10,000 cases, right? We saw that the women who don't stay pregnant, their temperatures never got above 98 after ovulation, and that temperature rise is correlated with high progesterone. So when women are having miscarriages and their temperatures are low, we don't care about the progesterone. We care about fixing why that temperature is low. When the temperature gets high enough, the thing that makes the progesterone is sensitive to heat. And you need, like, good menstrual blood so that we can see there's a good lining. 4 days of bleeding, soaking about every 4 hours. Not more, wow. Not less, no cramping or clotting. And all of that is achievable.
Very, very fascinating. And do you think the modern medicine touches all these areas of concern?
None of them, which is why we have such a unique product. You know, it's, and some people are like, well, that's not even medicine. I was like, it's before medicine. It's really foundational work. Like, we're a wellness company. We don't want to get in bed with FDA or, you know, we're not a medical device. Literally all we do is we find the problems, we teach you how to fix them.
And like after this, you know, this conversation that you and I are having right now, I am led to believe that the entire Western medicine is ignoring the fertility aspect of you know, reproduction. And I feel like they're either ignoring it, forgetting it, or it's not important to them. Especially like I live in Canada and we have universal healthcare and they provide some of that stuff, but to a lesser degree. And I do feel like, I don't know why I feel that way, but I shouldn't. You know, if the option was for any government to, or any institution to produce babies versus, you know, bring the population from outside, I think the obvious choice would be is, you know, do whatever you want to do as a population, live your life, you know, whatever works for you, fine. If you have a baby, that's good. It's fine. If you don't, nobody's going to cry about it. Mm-hmm. And it becomes like, for me, it sounds like after this conversation, feels like you're focusing on that aspect of reproduction and healthy reproduction. And somebody else is just giving them an aspirin. That's the equivalent to it.
Actually, they do. That is exactly what doctors
do. Did I exaggerate?
They give them fucking aspirin. They're like, now the thing is like, give everybody 81 milligrams of aspirin. Because clotting factors, you know, probably, I don't know what the incidence rate is, but a significant amount of women who are trying to get pregnant can have clotting factors, and those clotting factors can be disruptive to the quality of the lining. So yep. Because some women are getting pregnant from 81 milligrams of aspirin, they're giving all women that they can't figure out what's wrong 81 milligram. And I was like, well, that's quite dangerous, because we think of baby aspirin as being very benign, but if we want to have enough blood to have a thick enough lining to support implantation, but if the person already has 4 days of bleeding or less, 3 days of bleeding, and it's not, you know, it's not very heavy, and you give her 81 milligrams of aspirin, a blood thinner, guess what happens? She gets less blood, and the blood gets more watery and less implantable. And I always say, if something is strong, we just can't, we have to stop extrapolating, because it works for like 10% or 20 or 30% of the population, that everybody should get it. What's missing in all of medicine is personalization. It's just what the AI does. Like we talked about, like you have a migraine, instead of just giving you a pill, well, let's see, do you drink caffeine? Are you getting enough sleep? Tell me what you eat. Do you have food sensitivities? Like, but unfortunately with a pharmaceutical incentivized system, it's better to not know, because I always say, like, my practice was always built on, I don't want any lifers. I had a very wait list, like a year wait list. And so I was very incentivized to fix their problems and get them to move along. I was like, I don't want to see you every week. It's too boring for me. There's nothing else to fix. We did all the work. I like the new stuff. I like the problems. I like to do my polymath stuff. And so I'd always say, like, I don't want any lifers. I'm going to do my best to get you out of your informants. Then I want you to go tell all your friends. That's all I ask.
Now, for the audience, the fertility market is, and I don't know, I'm just doing the research here. So fertility market estimated around to 3 to 4 billion globally. I don't know if that number is true or not. And there is a huge, and I'm assuming there's not real studies out there, 3 to 4 billion. I'm thinking like, this is way low. I don't know where this number in it's coming out of, which study somebody put out somewhere. I have no idea. With the wave of femtech startup entering the space, I mean, there's a lot of these things are in, there's a lot of technologies to take advantage of right now. And there's a lot of possibilities out there to solve issues and solve problems on a medical field. In fact, I interviewed somebody on the channel a few months ago now. They're using voice to decode disease cases. And they mapped the voice into an AI model where the AI, it doesn't matter what language you speak. The doctor could be having a conversation with you, or a practitioner could have a conversation with you. And there's a little machine that spits out your case. Could be dementia, could be diabetes, whatever it is. Obviously, it's one of the markers in the health profile. You still have to do blood tests and all that stuff. But you can see the advantage of technology. And we're still at the beginning of things now, where this is just baby steps. As these things continue evolving, I'm assuming you're looking 5 years down the road and you're thinking, oh my God, the stuff that I can do here are amazing with what we've got in front of us, so to speak. Now, you've been building this in this space, which is the femtech space, before even that was a word, before there was even a technology called femtech. Now there are hundreds of companies out there. What do you see when you look at the market in from an observer point of view that some observers miss, but you seem to be focused on?
I think that there's a lot of companies that get funded and launched that are useless. I'm kind of a jerk. I'm sorry. Like, I care.
That's reality. That's not being jerk. That's just great. Yeah, I mean, that's honest. I could tell you there's many PE firm, they put their money in places that shouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I think that that often femtech can be, and especially in the fertility space, can be predatory and take advantage of women. I think that wearables are predatory, and are so are fertility monitors, because monitoring fertility No tracker has ever been shown to increase any positive health benefits. No tracker. It's a jewelry. It's jewelry. Like, we built the software, then we built the ring around it just to capture the data. There's nothing fancy. You can get a million. You don't need any. What's valuable is what you do with the data. And that's what we've pioneered. You know, in the femtech sake, and in all of startup, I think my biggest thing that I see is that people, they're like, what's something cool that people complain about that we can make a lot of money doing, as opposed to what's a real problem, not like a little bit of a problem, but a real problem in health.
Absolutely.
So instead of like making a supplement that helps you ovulate, that's not the real problem. That's still another Band-Aid, right?
Symptom.
And I want to see more health tech. I mean, I kind of play with the idea of starting my own fund to ensure this, but of course I know nothing and I can't even count. So that would be a terrible VC, but I do have the point of view that, you know, we need to get more serious about holding companies like, you know, Aura and Whoop both IPO'd this month, and all over LinkedIn you see, oh, like they're the next, this is the new healthcare company. I'm like, forget about that. That is not a healthcare company. A wearable does not make you healthier. No matter how much marketing and advertising, whether you're worth $1 billion, that is jewelry for rich people. That's all it is.
Wow. I love that.
Sorry.
Peel the onion. I love that. And it stinks a little bit, but that's, who cares? This is what this podcast is about. Now,
let's just be honest, right? About like, it's just vanity. Like people, I feel like they don't do anything with the data. It doesn't change it. You see, oh, I still got 4 hours sleep. I know shit, I got 4 hours of sleep because I couldn't sleep last night.
Imagine the amount of data a human have right now on any topic. Pick, you know, the topic that we're talking about right now. I'm assuming there's terabytes of data, gazillion terabytes of data out there. And if we collect all of this together, it has to yield to better results. It has to yield to better outcome. And this is the conversation that we're not talking about.
So. Right.
I'm sorry.
It does it if, like, you know, like Kai, her success metrics for herself are she has to learn every day.
Yeah.
She has
to
learn something. And at the end of the month, she has to create a report of what she learned and how we should change the app and the experience to make sure to deliver better and better outcomes. Her whole goal is to deliver a healthy baby. Right.
No.
That's the only metric that matters.
Absolutely. I mean, if it doesn't deliver results, why are we going through this? To take the $12,000, I don't know how much it costs in the US, but
25.
Yeah. It's the same here in Canada. I think it's in the same range because some of it is covered by the universal health care or some of it isn't. And you have to do your own. You start paying through the nose in some of that stuff. So, and you know, like most, you know, mentioned social media earlier, which made me think of anytime somebody has an issue, they run to, I don't know, YouTube, TikTok, LinkedIn, whatever they go to, and they try to get an advice from there. So is there a trend that you're seeing that you think is dangerous of advice?
Especially, I mean, basically on TikTok, that's where I'm most active, is on TikTok, you will see people who said, you know, I tried for 4 years and then this is exactly what I did to get pregnant. And what I always say is like having infertility is not like having vitamin D deficiency, where you don't have enough vitamin D, you take vitamin D, it fixes it, right? Very straightforward. Vitamin D isn't, I mean, infertility isn't a deficiency of fertility. It's a complex syndrome that's a reflection of your underlying issues. So what worked for one person is so unlikely to work for you, but these women will really latch onto it and be like, but she got pregnant at 40, like doing this, you know? And so again, if it's just because it worked for one person, if it really worked for that one person, but you don't have that problem, you're actually, what you're doing is hurting your fertility. And so I think that, there's, first of all, there's just people on social media who had one experience who are now sort of claiming to be experts because they got themselves pregnant. Then you have sort of pseudoscience, like I took a weekend class and now I'm a nutrition consultant. And that's just as bad. I think that they're just as under experienced. It really takes clinical experience, you know, and I would be in the category of pseudoscience from a doctor too, probably. I mean, acupuncture is a little bit more, but I can at least, I'm the only one standing who can produce the data. Like I can produce the results. I'm like, pseudoscience or not, I beat all of you guys for free.
And especially like with those paid actors that they're out there promoting some company and they just pay them a little bit of money to get on social media and promote that company for whoever needs it to be promoted. I mean, we had a...
And it's persuasive.
It is persuasive. Like I, my wife told me the other day, she said, hey, Robin, we got to try this restaurant. It's a Turkish sweets place here in Toronto.
Ooh.
And I love sweets. So I said, oh yeah, let's do that. How did you find out about it? She said, take a look at this TikTok thing about the restaurant. So I'm looking at, oh, delicious. It looks beautiful. We go up there. I swear to God, we just sat down and we said, oh, we're going to leave. Got nothing to do with what you showed me. And I actually told the guy, I showed him the video. I said, does this look anything like what you showed me here? I don't know what you filmed this.
Interesting.
Well, it's very crazy. I mean,
to be fair, I do use TikTok for that, like for restaurants. And in Austin, it seems pretty reliable. Like,
No, I mean, there's uses for everything, at least some degree of honesty. I mean, for those out there who are trying to promote something, right? But for me, I use those social medias to record my own voice, to speak about my own experiences, what I did and what I'm doing. I'm not promoting anybody. And I refrain, a channel has been kept that way since the beginning. I don't have any sponsors. I don't sell vitamins. I don't sell anything on the channel. I just want to make sure it stays pure. And that's why, right now, the channel is top five conversational category in the conversational category worldwide. It's because of that. Authentic conversation, hard to come by. Most people want to, obviously, you don't launch an initiative unless you're thinking about making money out of it. I didn't. I do it just because I enjoy the conversation, to be honest. Now, IVF, let's talk a little bit about this one, because it's often presented as the answer. And would you mind, for those audience who doesn't know what IVF is, explain to that to them? And in your opinion, where does it come in the decision tree?
Two good questions. So IVF, in vitro fertilization, is basically where they give the woman medication. This is for the more severe cases. They give her medication that makes her ovulate more than one egg, up to 20. Can be more, but that's dangerous for the women. And then they go in and they use a super long needle through your abdomen and go through your parts. I don't know how family this is. And retrieve those eggs. Then they're in a petri dish. Then they take the husband's sperm and either they pour the sperm into it, that's cheaper, or they do something where they can actually inseminate. So they pick out the best ones and then they inseminate them. Each one comes with more price. They grow them and they wash them in a lab. And when they get to the right phase, they put them back inside. And those have success rates between 35 and 50%. It typically takes 2.5 cycles to have a baby. In the US, $25,000 a pop. So we're looking at $70,000. And second question, I can't remember what the second part of the question
is. Yeah, where is it in the decision tree? When do you get, in your opinion, now we need to do this versus, exhaust all the other options first?
So in my opinion, I think that both inseminations, IUI and IVF, they absolutely have a place, as do surgeries and pharmaceuticals. But your point, the order of operations is a little bit out of whack. So in my opinion, what should happen is 1 year, you use the Conceivable app. You optimize everything, you get your conceivable score above 65. And if you don't get pregnant use it, once your score gets above 65, if you don't get pregnant in 4 months, then do IUI. Everything is optimized as possible and you're ready to stay pregnant. So now IUI actually has a better chance of working. 3 cycles only of IUI. If that doesn't work, then you go on to IVF. The whole time you keep using the app, because the medications are going to cause side effects we need to clean up. Like the Clomid is very drying, it dries up your cervical discharge. We want to protect against that. And then I always say, don't do IVF until you have 4 days of bleeding, soaking a tampon or a pad about every 4 hours without clotting. That was the kind of menstrual cycle that showed the highest likelihood of implantation in our studies.
Now, you mentioned TikTok earlier, which is really impressive. You have 300,000 followers on TikTok. I'm sure the number have grown since I've scanned this one. And specifically in the health, for a health tech founder talking about fertility, that's pretty amazing. You're not, talking about other topics, you're talking about a specific topic in healthcare related and specifically on the fertility side. How did that happen? How did you get to that number? How did you communicate in a point where you said, probably you have all women and men following you on this topic, probably?
Well, I have two TikToks, two channels. One is about periods and menstrual health, and that was the first one. And then the fertility one is the second one. And the first one started during the pandemic. One of our investors is Gary Vaynerchuk, and he's a big digital marketing guru in New York, billionaire. And so another investor said, I think you should go spend the day with Gary. And I was like, okay. And that was pretty exciting because he's super famous. It'd be like going to spend the day with Barack Obama in my world, And so he's like me, he cusses a lot. He's very sassy, sort of similar people, troublemaking, irreverent. And excuse my language, but at the end of the day, he goes, you need to fucking be on TikTok all day long.
And I was like, That's direct.
I was 50, right? And I had never even been on TikTok. And all I knew about TikTok was people dancing. And I was like, so I'm going to dance about periods and tampons? And what? These put me in such a baby. Pull your panties up, get out your phone every single day, 3 TikToks a day for 90 days and call me. And in 90 days, I had 200,000 followers.
Wow. Wow.
Mostly
what a story.
Who had not had their first period.
What a story.
I had 1 to 5,000 DMs a day about periods from little girls wanting the deets on it. And so finally, it was a pandemic, so we had a lot of time, And so I started doing a live show every day there, and I'd have 2 to 5,000 girls on the show every day, just asking questions I just got my period. I want to use tampons. I have no idea where to put it.
Wow.
It was very, sad.
Lack of education out there, huh?
A complete lack, my parents can't afford menstrual supplies. So oh, wow. This is kind of gross, but it's really to the point. She said, could I get, what I do is I, my mom, my parents can't afford anything. So, but I can't just like bleed into my clothes. So what I do is I go to school early or late and I go through the little period boxes. I know it's really disgusting. And try to
find I just feel sorry for the kid.
And find the ones that are not very used. Will that make me sick? And I cried, you know, I was like, and because these were happening every day, these kinds of comments and questions. So even in conceivable, you know, conceivable isn't only won't.
These conversations need to be out there. Like, I'm so frustrated right now because these conversations need to be out there. We don't talk about them often. We talk about everything else, how to solve, I don't know, margin in a company, how to solve profitability level in a place, or to how to increase revenue. Meanwhile, we've got these stories, you know, people can't afford the basic necessities out there. This is freaking frustrating, in my opinion.
I agree. We started, we had a period company, like for Chinese medicine for periods, and it's getting rolled up into conceivable because conceivable will ultimately be age 7 to 90. So wherever you are in the reproductive journey, we got you. And your virtual, you know, you have an AI virtual care team. So when you're 7 years old, if you're using the virtual care, you know, if you're using the app, I will be 7 years old with you. So Kai and the team will age with you even.
Absolutely. Like for the audience, look, if you guys are trying to solve the world's hunger out there, fine, kudos to you. But if you want to talk to me about anything else before you even talk to Kristen about this specific problem that we're just talking about right now, kids cannot afford, girls cannot afford the basic necessities as they become teenagers and young women out there. I swear to God, if somebody wants to talk to me about how to increase profitability, don't talk to me about this one. Talk to me how you're going to impact somebody's life. If you're not going to talk to me about how you're going to impact somebody's life, just leave me alone. Go focus on what's good in life. And what's good in life is helping others. And this is like really, like right now, I feel like this is, for me, it framed my entire podcast. This is the moment, in my opinion, that this entire podcast was waiting for, is to impact humanity in a way humanity needed to. I've had every topic on this podcast, every topic. But normally they're generally around mental health, supporting a CEO in their mental journey or in their, you know, leadership role or whatever the case may be, or AI or technology or languages. We're still talking in 2026, middle of the year 2026, about people's basic necessities, specifically when it comes to period and girls trying to get their early childhood or early teenage life or whatever you want to call it into the realm of normalcy, and they can, and their parents cannot afford that. What do you, if that was your daughter, what would you do? If that was your sister, what would you do? Mm-hmm. What would you do? What's the answer? In my opinion, for the audience, you better have a good answer for this one.
I've got the answer. Go ahead. What we had at Brazen.
I had to get on a soapbox on this one.
No. I'm glad you did because it's really important. It is really important. And I think like for people who want to start businesses, I think that to your point, like there's all kinds of stupid companies you can start that will solve problems, like, you know, problems. But being a startup founder is really hard. It's relentless. It is demoralizing. It will make you question everything. And so if you're working on something that you can't not work on, that you are so impassioned by, it is really hard to make it through the hard. It's kind of like a marriage, right? It's really hard to stay the course when you don't have any funding and nobody wants you and the thing is breaking and your customers are, it's really lonely. So find your thing that is most passionate. What we're going to do for the menstrual thing and what we started to do at Brazen before we are kind of rolling it up into conceivable is we are, you know, I did a lot of research on menstrual supplies and we have a lot of companies that are out there trying to like make pad making machines and, you know, bunch of whole pretty creative things, especially, but what we have and also reusable pads. But the problem is in a lot of countries, water is becoming more and more scarce. And in a lot of countries, people have to wash their clothes and dishes in the same river. And imagine like a 10 or 11 year old girl walking down to the water with her dirty menstrual supplies where everybody else is cleaning their food. She's never going to do that. It can't be water dependent. So my idea is to use to provide menstrual cups for every girl on the planet. That's my goal. And so a menstrual cup is like a little cup. It's not even this big. It's very soft silicone. They last 10 years. You basically just squeeze it and you pop it in and it catches everything. No leaking. You buy one and you have it for 10 years. You can wash it with a few tablespoons of water and some Kleenex. So it's very hygienic. It doesn't have the risk of toxic shock syndrome. It doesn't have lead like tampons do in them and all of these things. And You can buy them in the store. They're about $30 to $40. But then when I started doing what I like to do and started like researching it, I found that I could source them for 41 cents each. And then like you, Robin, I got really mad because I'm like, these assholes who are selling these cups for $40, they really need that much margin to have a profitable company.
Wow. From 40 cents to $40?
Yeah. And that was not at scale. It's a stupid little piece of silicon that...
I just can't believe it.
Yeah, I would say like $30 to $40, depending on where you are. And sometimes you get two cups for that, and they give
this
you
is like almost like, I don't know, I can't do the quick math, but I was thinking like 4,000%.
1,000%. Yeah, it's ridiculous. And so we started something at Brazen that we're going to need a big round of funding to implement all these, but the $5 cup is what
You know, thank you for bringing this topic to the channel. I really appreciate it. This is something that our 2.5 million viewers out there will be thinking about this for a while.
This is gonna
stay with me, at least. It will stay with me for a while. I'll be talking about this podcast here with you for a long while to go. I'll be referencing.
What we want to do with the five cup, because I thought this is really gonna, I was like, well, if I can source it for, I'm happy for this to be zero profit, right? Can make profit in other places, but I think it's like a human right, like what you were saying, to have a tool, you know, something that you can feel good.
I mean, think about all the countries, Africa, India, everywhere where you've everywhere. Got no access to anything.
Yeah. So with the $5 cup, every time somebody buys a cup, it costs me with shipping like $1, you know, after I ship it to them. And so that leaves $4 of profit, which means I can buy 5 more cups. And so every time somebody buys one cup, we give
it's an accelerator away. Program.
It is. And but then we give 5 away. We basically give 5 away for free. So places like Africa, India, places where even in the US where people homeless shelters. Imagine you are home a homeless woman and you have 1 pair of pants and then your period comes. And you don't have any supplies. You're totally yeah. screwed. You know, just like
you know, all the other problems nowadays in life, they become so minimal in comparison to this one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a rounding error for, you know, so I'm really excited about that. Like people don't like to use cups very much because it is a little bit invasive. And if you never, you got to kind of touch yourself to get it in there and stuff. But
what's the alternative? You've got nothing.
Well, pads, you know, you could use pads,
I mean, if you don't have access to anything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and just I think that people should be touching themselves. Like, you know, you have to get acquainted with your body. You let other people touch it, but you won't touch it.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me, what's the next 5 years look like for you, for Conceivable and any other objective that you have beside the Nobel Prize?
I hope that in the next year that we launch all of the experiences across Conceivable, that we're working on some technology right now, which is basically face scan technology. So I think that wearables are going to be a thing of the past. I'm gonna actually make them a thing of the past because what we can get from a scan is much better than a wearable. You can't get persistent monitoring like you can from a wearable, but... So we want women to check in the morning. So the way that they'll check in is they'll hit the thing, there'll be 4 questions. And during those questions, it'll be scanning her and it can get her body composition. It can use voice sentiment to capture because women are big fat liars about how stressed they are. I don't mean that in a mean way. It's because women have been trained to be in
want to be strong, right? So yes,
strong, pretty, and happy. That's what women are allowed to do.
Yeah.
That's it. So stress
is not on the list.
No, stressed, mad is definitely not on the list. Furious, full of rage, disappointed. None of those feelings are appropriate. So when we ask them, how stressed are you? They don't tell us the truth. They're like, it's not that bad. But if we cross-reference that against their heart rate variability, we can actually see how stressed they are.
Sure.
We can see it in their basal body temperatures because instead of being smooth, it's really sawtooth like an EKG. So that voice sentiment will allow to say like, hey, listen, Robin, you told me that you weren't very stressed, but from your voice sentiment analysis seems like there's a lot of stress. Do you want to, let's just be real. Let's really dig in what's going on. The girl usually starts crying because she's, you know, she's like, oh, I'm so stressed because she's gotten permission. I'm really excited about that. And I don't even know, like, because where AI is going, I can't even map it. Like what's possible and what
can I help you? What can I help you with?
I need right now, I'm about to fundraise in 4 to 6 months, like the app is going to launch in a few weeks. So I need help with promotion, right? Getting people excited about using the app and participating and really digging
hopefully
in.
This podcast send the signal out there.
I hope that too. Second, any angel investors. So we have a small round of 500,000 that's open right now before in 6 months, we're going to raise a huge round to get all of those things built. But we've been a little bit bootstrapping mostly to this point, but I want to raise $200,000 to get as many users in 3 months as possible, because that's then a signal to investors. Like we already have 32 patents. We already have the, you know, the structure. We have everything's in place already. Mm-hmm. So all we're missing for that strong indicator is users. And because some insurance companies told us that if we can show the same numbers that we saw in the pilot in larger 5 to 10,000 users, that they will mandate that Conceival is the first line of defense for fertility. So the fastest I can get 10,000 users is what I need.
Well, we're going to do what we can here on the podcast, and we're going to push this as much as possible. I will be producing the main event, which is the conversation that we've had right now. And we'll also be producing 25, 26 short videos. Feel free to use them in any way you want in your social media. And I'll also be producing a blog post summarizing this conversation for whoever doesn't want to probably take the time and listen to all the audios and the videos that we've got to put out there. And we're averaging 1,200 downloads a day, so it has to hit the wire pretty strong. And this one will be strong.
I encourage everyone, like as you're marketing this, Robin, to say like, this is a conversation about fertility that everyone needs to hear about, because one, what we're going to be talking about,
it's more than that. I think it's about women's health. I mean, this is at various stage of your life. Don't think about, you know, the audience. I'm not talking about a woman in the mid-30s or mid-20s. This is from young kids to all the way to old adults and even seniors.
Like us.
It's at a various stage of life. Women's health, we talk about as if it's a solved problem. After this conversation, I'm thinking it's not a solved problem.
Nothing is solved. Nothing in women's health is solved. There's not one thing that we're doing right in women's health currently, except for prescribing medications.
I want to thank you, Kirsten. No, thank you for your work you do. Thank you for what you've done. And after today, I'm a big supporter of yours. Consider me in your corner.
I appreciate you so much, Robin. Thank you. It's been a really great conversation. You're an excellent interviewer. And I hope that this sparked some interest, passion, curiosity in the audience. Reach out to me if you need help. If you want to get involved in what we're doing, please, you know.
I will reach out.
You want. Yeah, reach out.
Thank you so much. For the audience, hey, listen, this has been, to me, and I don't know about what the audience thinks, but I'm sure you'll let me know. This has been genuinely illuminating conversation, in my opinion. We've spent a little bit of time here with Kirsten, dropping the bucket of what she's been spending time on, 20 years, you know, being told often implicitly that, you know, what you knew didn't fit the domain or the framework. That's how she started. And she said, no, hell with you. I'm going to do my own. I'm going to go create my own solutions. And she rightly did and successfully did. And as we articulated in this conversation with Kirsten today, the obstacles she had to overcome, what she've built already, and what people are thinking about this, and what your engagement level is, specifically on 300,000 people on social media trying to solve a problem that most humanity thought it was solved already. This is, in my opinion, the best wake-up call that we could have on this channel. People need to wake up to this issue, need to think about it differently, look at it differently in the context of what problem are we trying to solve at this stage. And women's health is very important issue for this podcast. Very important issue for this podcast. Thank you for coming on the channel, Kirsten, again, one more time. Anything else you'd like to add before I wrap it up?
Nope, just whatever I can do to help anybody, just reach out. That's the only thing.
Absolutely. And if anybody wants to get a hold of or participate in the program that Kirsten Karshner is launching or launched already, please reach out to me. I am connected with Kirsten, I'll introduce you, no problem. And I hope this conversation has sparked some ideas in people, how they can get involved, how they can support Kirsten and her initiative. And for the audience who's coming in on YouTube, thanks for watching us. If you're coming on our audio channels, thanks for listening in. And if you're reading the blog post, thank you for reading the blog post. I really appreciate it. Thank you for helping me record episode 224. Kirsten, thank you so much for being such a gracious guest. And I appreciate you being with me and grateful to have had this conversation with yourself. And for the audience, I'll see you at the next episode. Thank you, everybody.